Today on Against the Grain, what can Hannah Arendt teach us about our relationship with nature and the built environment? And what's happened to the balance between creating places and preserving them? I'm CS. Hamilton College professor Peter Canavo joins us to discuss the politics of place in an era of rampant commodification and development. Coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Peter Canavo understands and acknowledges that Hannah Arendt was not primarily an environmental thinker, but he's found in Arendt's book The Human Condition, published in 1958, key insights into humans' relationship to nature and to the built environment. In fact, he sees Arendt's work as prescient, as anticipating later critiques put forward by environmentalists, critiques of consumerism and of unregulated development and sprawl. Canavo, an associate professor of government at Hamilton College, also believes we're in a crisis of place, a crisis brought on by an overemphasis on the creation of places and a corresponding neglect of their preservation. Peter Canavo is co-editor with Joseph Lane Jr. of the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon, to which he contributed a chapter called Hannah Arendt, Place, World, and Earthly Nature. He is also the author of The Working Landscape, Founding, Preservation, and the Politics of Place. When Peter Canavo joined me in studio, I asked him what motivated him to read Hannah Arendt with a focus on environment and place.
What motivated me to look at Arendt in this way was going back to graduate school. I read The Human Condition, and I was struck by how her description of the world that we create out of nature has a lot in it about environmental insights, our relationship to the spatial environment, the natural environment. At the same time, I also came across an essay by a colleague of mine named Kerry Whiteside, who talked about Hannah Arendt as an ecological thinker. That also really clued me in to some of these aspects of hers. Now, Whiteside's essay is more about her critique of consumerism, of consumption, of mass society. What I did was I went further and looked into her concept of place and our relationship with the spatial environment, with the earth.
Right. And by space and place, you mean not just what you call earthly nature. You also refer to the built environment.
Exactly. Space is really more of an abstract concept involving dimension. What I'm really talking about is place. And place is fundamentally a human construct. That doesn't mean that the world doesn't exist outside of our perceptions. The world is certainly out there. There's an objective, natural, material reality. But when we conceive of it as coherent places with, you know, more or less specified boundaries, characteristics, that's really a human sort of perceptual overlay onto the world. And Arendt talks about creating a world, or what she calls the world, as opposed to earthly nature, or also calls the human artifice, which is also a human creation. Now, she emphasizes also the physical dimensions of work, of creating physical, enduring things, as well as action, of our social interactions, our discourse, our words, our deeds, which give meaning to that constructed world. When I talk about place, I actually see it a little more broadly than that, in that place can also refer to unbuilt, natural landscapes, terrains, locales that we've delineated as coherent places. And that's something she doesn't really directly talk about, though she kind of implies that the human artifice can include those things as well.
Well, let's jump into some of the concepts and terms that Arendt uses, and then later on we can get your sense of where you might depart from her understanding of, well, for example, three kinds of basic activities. So in her book, The Human Condition, Hannah Arendt identifies and describes labor, work, and action. So let's start with labor. What did Arendt mean by labor?
Labor is the activity through which we sustain ourselves as biological entities. It is the activity that involves us as natural beings. So labor involves food, getting food, shelter, clothing, basically maintaining our life processes, reproduction, maintaining our shelter, raising children. All of these processes are part of our biological side. And they're, in a sense, ephemeral processes, because what Arendt argues is that nature is ephemeral. It consumes its creations. It goes through cycles of birth, growth, death, decay, birth, growth, death, decay, and so on. And what labor does is it keeps us going within those cycles. But eventually, of course, we all die and things run down. So labor is kind of a cyclical thing. It's a cyclical activity. It doesn't involve creating enduring objects. It involves sustaining ourselves, surviving.
If nature consumes its creations and we are one of its creations, that does suggest that we are in a kind of antagonistic relationship to nature.
Yes, we are in a kind of antagonistic relationship to nature. Even though we biologically depend on nature, we're also seeking to transcend nature, to transcend these cycles. And so what we do is we exert force or change or disruption on nature and change it. We cut down trees. We dig minerals out of the earth. We reshape the land. We clear terrain. We build things. And we do that to create enduring objects, enduring places of habitation, artifacts. And that activity, Arendt deems work. Work is the creation of enduring objects. And work, in some ways, escapes this cyclical natural pattern in that what we create outlives us. It has a certain, not necessarily immortality, because nothing lasts forever, but it certainly endures beyond our biological existence, or ideally it does. I mean, some things don't, but there's always this intention of creating something enduring.
So labor is about sustaining and maintaining ourselves in a biological sense. And then work is about building things that will endure. And you write that work is guided a lot, or perhaps solely, by this idea of what's useful, right? What's useful to us.
Exactly. Work is creating things that are useful. And it also involves creating things from a plan. So it has a means-ends relationship. And concept of work in this sense, Arendt gets from Aristotle. But the idea is that work creates things according to a given plan, and then that plan is executed and a thing is created. So that's also one of the distinguishing aspects of work.
Okay, and so then the third concept that Arendt introduces and describes in The Human Condition is action. So what is action and how does it differ from labor as she defines it and work as she defines it?
Action is the activity of words and deeds that take place between people. It is basically the world of social interactions in which people initiate processes through acts of speech, discourse, political acts, and they create new beginnings. And then these processes are sort of spread out into the web of human relationships and have sort of further effects. People respond to them. people initiate their own forms of action. So action is probably the sort of most, maybe the hardest to define of these three, but it's basically the words and deeds that transpire between people. And it creates a sort of a collective social reality. We might talk about it creates culture, it creates a shared political reality, it creates common ends, shared values, discourse. So in some ways, it's non-material. It's more, again, it's words and deeds. It's as opposed to making things. Action is not guided by a plan of fabrication like work is. Like when I make a chair, I say I have a plan to make a chair. I have maybe a set of instructions that I use, materials, and I then achieve this goal of making a chair. Action doesn't really have a defined goal. It's not instrumental to anything like work is. It's an activity that sort of exists for itself. When I if I make a political speech, or I mean, I might have a goal, a political goal in mind, but the speech itself is sort of its own end. It's an action that sort of exists for itself, but then it has its own consequences in the web of human relationships. And those consequences, in many cases, are beyond my control. So it's inevitably a collective act. When I have a conversation, say, in the public square, metaphorically, if I have a political conversation or go to a political meeting or really have any kind of interaction with others, the sort of consequences of that just spread beyond that particular interaction and whatever my intention was in initiating it.
Well, you mentioned political speech. So what is the relationship, as Arendt sees it, between action and politics?
Well, she sees action as the sort of the quintessential, or politics rather, as the sort of quintessential form of action. Politics is a realm of deliberation about the common good. And it's a realm in which everyone is sort of free, ideally, to initiate new discussions, new beginnings, new forms of discourse. And so what it is also a realm of freedom, because it's unconstrained by the demands of nature, the need to survive and maintain oneself. It's not constrained by the plans and instrumental processes of work. I mean, when I make a chair or bake a cake or whatever, I have to follow a certain plan. Action is a matter of freedom. It's a matter of initiating new beginnings in our shared social existence. So she equates that freedom with the world of politics, the world of political deliberation, deliberation about the common good, deliberation about the shared ends of a community, of society. And in many ways, this goes back to Aristotle's notion of politics and to the ancient Greeks.
That's Peter Canavo. He's associate professor of government at Hamilton College. We are talking about an article he wrote about Hannah Arendt and place, world, and earthly nature. He contributed that article to a volume he co-edited. It's called Engaging Nature, Environmentalism, and the Political Theory Canon. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So if action is about words and also deeds, then is action also partly about naming and assigning certain labels to the things around us?
Yes. Arendt says that without action, the world would be a heap of unrelated things. So if we created a material world, but we didn't name it, we didn't give it significance, we didn't define the things we created, we didn't talk about their relationships, establish their relationships, name them, the world wouldn't really make sense to us. I mean, it's almost, you can't even really imagine such a scenario of us creating this whole built up worlds without actually saying anything about it or conceptualizing it in any way. But the point is that in order to create this human artifice, we don't just do the material work of transforming nature, but we also need to engage in action. We need to name it, define it, describe it, identify it, to create places out of it, to create identifiable things, to give these things a history, to tell stories about them, to tell stories about our relationships with them. So this human artifice that we've created is as much a product of discourse, of our social web of relations, as it is of physical work.
Give us an example of a place that we create via action, via, for example, speech.
Well, one place we could create purely, well, not entirely purely, but very much through speech, through action, is to identify a wilderness landscape. So let's take the Adirondacks, for example. That's near to where I live. The Adirondacks is a mountainous region in upstate New York. And it's also a place where in the late 19th century, the state of New York created a park. So the state basically drew a line around this area and they created a place. Now, that line doesn't exist physically. We didn't build a wall. There was an act of legislation, a political deed created this boundary for the Adirondacks. Then that boundary was instantiated through various policies, through a constitutional amendment that deemed that much of it would remain forever wild, et cetera, et cetera. But what we did was we took an area out of the terrain of upstate New York and we drew this line and we created an incredibly important place through action, not by building something. Now, again, eventually, in the long term, even these wilderness areas that we define, there may be some physical manipulation through some management in a very extremely limited way in protected wilderness areas. There may be a few outposts for Park Service or Forest Service employees. But basically, these especially protected wilderness areas are really just delineated through action, not through physical transformation. So our whole world, whether it's wilderness or the built environment or zones of the ocean that are marked out on nautical maps, is delineated through, in part through action, not necessarily through physical change.
So when we create something, when we name it, when we found it, that's a word that you use a lot in your book, The Working Landscape, via action, then, especially when I think about, say, wilderness areas, then there is the urge and often the necessity to preserve it. And I wonder if you could maybe start with what Arendt says about preservation and its necessity.
Preservation is important, and it's important for Arendt, but in a much more subtle way. I mean, a lot of what she talks about is founding, creating the human artifice, using action to give meaning to it. But there's also the implicit sense that this world we create has to endure, that it's not just here, created to be here for today or, you know, just a short period of time. But it has to endure, and that it has to endure because it gives us a sense not only of a permanent home on Earth that we can inhabit, but also an enduring sense of identity. She says that people can relate to, for example, the same chair and table. They can come back to it and relate to these same enduring objects and also at the same time maintain their identity. So preservation is part of what she's talking about, but it's much more beneath the surface. It's more subtle. Her more explicit emphasis is on founding. Again, action is involved. It talks about new beginnings. So is preservation a new beginning, or does it actually restrain action? And to some degree, it does restrain action, because if we preserve what we've created, then that does act as some constraint on what we can build later in terms of work, but also on the new beginnings that we can create through action. Even just naming a place constrains future actions in terms of wanting to call it something else. So one point that's important is that preservation itself, just like founding, can be included within action. Action involves deliberating about the common good, about what our community will be like, what ends we should pursue. And that can include what meanings we give to places and what we want to preserve and why we want to preserve them, why some places are meaningful to us and need to be maintained, they need to endure. So preservation exists in this rather ambiguous relationship with action. In some ways, it constrains it, but in other ways, it can be seen as part of action, just as founding is. Now, the other aspect of preservation that comes in with Arendt is the fact that she says that Earth, our earthly home, is really the quintessential aspect of the human condition. It's very fundamental to who we are. And briefly, why she says that and what I draw out in this chapter is that she is arguing that on the one hand, we are trying to define ourselves in distinction to the earth, in distinction to nature. We're trying to transcend it through work, through action. But in another sense, having nature there as something to sort of work against or work in relation to is part of what defines us as human beings. And also, the stability of the natural world itself is implicitly, at least in what she's saying, is necessary to maintain the very sort of creations that we make through our interventions into nature, our transformations of nature. So there's a kind of ambivalent relationship with nature, but part of that ambivalent relationship is the need to actually preserve nature, preserve the earth.
I'm CS. My guest is Peter Canavo. He teaches in the government department at Hamilton College. He's the author of The Working Landscape, Founding, Preservation, and the Politics of Place. And he also co-edited with Joseph Lane Jr. the volume Engaging Nature, to which he contributed an article about Hannah Arendt and her view of place. And again, for those of you who are just joining us, I want to redefine the three terms we're using a lot, because these terms we're using as defined by Arendt: labor is the activity of attending to bodily needs, such as the need for food. It's concerned with life-sustaining consumption rather than creation. Work, according to Arendt in the book The Human Condition, is the activity through which human beings create enduring physical objects from pre-given plans or designs. And action is the activity of words and deeds transpiring directly between persons. Okay, so Arendt then sees the stability of earthly nature and the built environment to be very important to our continued existence. So, right, there's a strong sense of preservation, of keeping something the same or keeping it at least in a stable condition. So is it correct to see that as an environmentalist stance, right? That she thinks that there's a large part of what's out there that needs to be preserved rather than destroyed or transformed in significant ways?
Yes, her stance is environmentalist in a way that precedes the modern environmental movement, or rather it's an environmentalist stance, and it precedes by over 10 years, really, the modern environmental movement, which started around 1970. And we're talking about a work that was written in 1958. What she's concerned about is a few things. One is the increasing instrumentalization of the world. Instrumentalization is the turning of things into instruments for further purposes. And when you instrumentalize something, you inherently devalue it. You treat it as a thing to be used. And interestingly, even though she says we have to even exert violence against nature, she's concerned at the same time that our instrumentalizing activities, which to a large degree is what work is based on, instrumentalizing and using things to create new things, she's concerned that that is going rampant and that we are instrumentalizing everything and that things cease to have value. And she's simultaneously concerned about the instrumentalization of the natural world in a way that ultimately destroys any sort of dignity that nature might have, and also the instrumentalization of the human artifice, the destruction of what we've created. And what that turns into, that sort of unrestrained instrumentalization, is rampant consumption. We make and remake and destroy, and we basically consume all that's around us. And what rampant consumption then sort of degenerates into is actually a kind of labor, where everything becomes consumed in a kind of
a cycle.
A cycle and a kind of perversion of the life process, where, you know, and she doesn't say this explicitly, but wants become needs. I mean, we see that today in our society, where we don't just want to have as big a house or as big a car as possible, but we need to. And so our needs become out of bound, they become boundless, and we basically, everything becomes consumed in this kind of cancerous sort of or monstrous version of the life process. So things get instrumentalized as work, and everything ultimately gets instrumentalized, and then that degenerates into a kind of mass consumption, which then becomes a kind of version of labor, which she sees labor as a kind of lowly activity. It's not what represents the sort of highest aspects of human existence. And, you know, one might take issue with that. I think one should. But her point, though, is that we lose these other forms of activity, of work and action, that do create an enduring world. And when work and then labor sort of run rampant, we basically consume the world around us. And you can see that in the whole culture of mass consumption. And that whole critique of consumption, which was starting to maybe get going in the 50s, really took hold later in the 60s and early 70s, where you suddenly had this full-bore explosion of environmental consciousness. And she's really anticipating that.
Does Hannah Arendt, does she see this consumption and this instrumentalism, this extreme instrumentalism, arising from the relationship that humans have come to have with their environment, both the natural environment and the built environment?
Yes, she talks about a kind of alienation from the world around us. There are various aspects of that, one of which is the kind of distance we develop from the world through things like quantification. There's also the alienation of seeing everything as an instrument, seeing everything as an object of consumption. So what basically she's talking about are processes that she associates with modernity that tend to detach us from a sense of the world being a home for us, and turning the world into an object of consumption, turning it into something we just quantify and measure and don't appreciate in a qualitative way. These are aspects of alienation. One thing she contrasts this with, not in The Human Condition, but in a collection of works called Between Past and Future, is the notion of cultivation and care, which are activities that have a more nurturing quality, and they they don't destroy what's around us. They don't subject it to quantification, but they sort of work with nature, work with natural processes to cultivate things out of nature that we can use and that can help us to flourish. One might think of agriculture. In fact, the root of agriculture in terms of cultivation, certain types of farming, which work with rather than try to overwhelm natural processes, as falling under this notion of care and cultivation.
Peter Canavo, Associate Professor of Government at Hamilton College. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Peter about Hannah Arendt and also his own understandings of founding and preservation and the politics of place. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Peter Canavo teaches in the Department of Government at Hamilton College, where he directs its environmental studies program. He's working on a book about the connections between environmentalism and civic republicanism in the U.S. He's the author of The Working Landscape, which examines the conflict between development and preservation as a major factor behind what he calls our contemporary crisis of place. And he wrote an article about Hannah Arendt and the politics and the philosophy of place in a volume that he co-edited. It's called Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. It's published by the MIT Press. We have links to Peter and his work on our website, againstthegrain.org. One thing you're very interested in is how places are created, how they are named, what process goes into the action, the words and deeds that create many places. And you point out, and I think you point out that Hannah Arendt points out, that this delineation of places doesn't always take place by consensus, right? That the deliberation isn't always smooth and easy.
Deliberation is not always smooth and easy. In fact, one question might be, has it ever been smooth and easy, and has it ever been truly democratic? I mean, in some ways, we're talking about an ideal that one should aspire to and try to approximate, not an ideal that's just utopian fantasy. And the better we are at it, the better off we are, and the better we are at creating places. Places usually don't arise through deliberation, through democratic deliberation. I mean, think of how places are created. They're often created through conquest, through colonization, through war, through government fiat, through developers, real estate interests, ethnic cleansing. I mean, I'm talking about all different ways that we create places in anti-democratic or non-democratic or even brutal ways. Places are often created despotically, whether by government or armies or corporations or private property owners, et cetera, et cetera. So that I see as a problem, because if one has to live in a place that has been forcibly created by others, or one is kicked out of a place because it's being forcibly transformed by others, that's problematic in the sense that that place is no longer your home. It's an alienating condition. It's, if we value democracy and self-determination, obviously that is in conflict with it. And it's something we surprisingly tolerate. When a developer decides to transform hundreds of acres into some sort of mega project, yeah, there's resistance from, you know, the community, and they have to go through environmental impact statements and hearings. But it's something that even in a ostensibly democratic society, we regard as basically something legitimate. This person is a private property owner. They have the right to do what they want with their property, even though they're not just someone with a house and a little lot, but someone who's a, you know, a huge developer or controls, you know, hundreds or thousands of acres. So in many cases, places are imposed on us. They're founded forcibly, despotically.
Well, even if democratic deliberation went into the creation of places, one could imagine that people have different opinions, right? Different opinions about what should be delineated, where it should be created. There could be a lack of consensus among the participants in that process.
Yeah, I mean, consensus is obviously would be great. I think the key is, as with any political process, is to have a democratic process that is open to ongoing contestation and deliberation, even if a majority might rule at a given point and affect a change in the landscape. So let's say a community like, for example, in the Dudley Street neighborhood in Boston, where they've had a whole sort of community redevelopment project, and the community there formed an organization, a nonprofit, the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative, which undertook a redevelopment of the area. Now, that process involved a lot of public meetings. They brought in as many members of the community as possible to discuss their plans for the area, which included new housing, a park, cleaning up empty trash-strewn lots, exercising eminent domain over properties over abandoned properties to redevelop them into housing. So that was a collective community-based act of founding and transformation. But it happened through an open process, through public meetings and bringing people from the community in to deliberate on this whole project. Now, there are obviously going to be people who disagree with that. And I think the key is to have a process that's open so that those people who may be unhappy with a decision today can at least come back and raise other proposals or challenge it or help to reevaluate it later on. You're obviously not going to get 100% consensus on how to either found or preserve a place because people have very different conceptions of it. And so what's important is that you have an open process. And what's also important is that you come to some provisional agreement on how to manage that place. Because if we wait for consensus, then nothing's going to happen. At the same time, we also want as open and deliberative a process as possible.
Peter Cannavo, C-A-N-N-A-V-O, Associate Professor of Government at Hamilton College. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You asked the question at the end of the essay you wrote for that volume, what would an Arendtian green politics look like? So how important would open, democratic, deliberative conversations and deliberations be to that kind of politics, do you think?
Well, I think it would actually be very important. I see this kind of politics as follows. And again, I'm not trying to spell out some rigid blueprint because that in some ways defeats the idea of a open democratic process where you tell people what they're supposed to do before they even set out to do it. Not that anyone would necessarily listen to me anyway, but but the idea is to institute deliberation at a very local level, neighborhoods within cities, small towns, to have as much local deliberation as possible about issues like neighborhood redevelopment, green spaces, even strategies for adapting to or being resilient in the face of climate change. And then working up from that, what I would envision is regional governments. And this experiment in regionalism has been done in a few places, most notably in Portland, Oregon, where you take a metropolitan area, or perhaps if you're in rural or wilderness areas, a watershed, and you bring these local communities together into some kind of regional deliberation about the overall environmental, social, infrastructural quality of their region. And this is, I think, where we could see this kind of democratic, deliberative politics of place sort of really being best instantiated.
Well, why regional? I mean, in some ways you're talking about localities, and then you're also talking about municipalities. Regional suggests larger, at times, a larger place than a municipality. So why the focus on the region?
The focus on the region, even from a purely democratic sense, is that smaller is not necessarily more democratic, and bigger is not necessarily less democratic. A lot of the issues we face today in terms of the places we inhabit, their character, their durability, and these issues include environmental issues, issues of distributional equity, quality of schools, of housing. A lot of those issues extend beyond the capacity of a city, let alone a neighborhood or a small town or a small jurisdiction, to really address. What often happens is now you have, for example, a metropolitan area like, take any major city. The city is fragmented, is fragmented into a whole bunch of small municipalities, special districts, school districts, water districts, local suburban governments, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what you get is a situation where you have a number of small communities, many of whom have very little control over the economic forces, the environmental forces, the social forces that are affecting them, because they're really too small to control these things. Then you get a few or relatively few communities which have a lot of power and wealth and are able to accumulate resources for themselves in terms of money and nice amenities, good schools, good housing, and then basically foist undesirable things like hazardous waste sites or sewage treatment plants or bus transfer stations, et cetera, on less powerful communities or inner cities within these metropolitan areas. And so you get all sorts of inequities, often along class and racial lines. What metropolitan or regional government does is it enables localities to coordinate more, to control these forces that are seemingly beyond their control, these forces that take place on this regional scale. So in a sense, the regional approach combined with local participation on legitimately local issues is in a sense more democratic than what we have now. Of course, there are lots of political obstacles to this, because one of the reasons our metropolitan areas are fragmented is because of the power of certain communities to maintain their independence and resist sharing resources with other communities that are, you know, less fortunate and less politically powerful. But again, regionalism, because it enabled small communities to have a sort of collective voice in controlling social, environmental, and economic processes, changes, and forces, is more democratic than the kind of municipal fragmentation we have now. So the recipe I'm seeing is a combination of local and regional democracy.
And I want to say that Peter Cannavo, my guest, he makes his argument, he makes the case for regional democratic governance in his book, The Working Landscape, Founding Preservation and the Politics of Place. And I want to stick with that book for a moment, because you argue in that tome that in the U.S. there's been an overemphasis on founding, that is, creating of places, to the exclusion of preservation of places. How so?
Well, we have an overemphasis on founding in that we basically have taken our landscape and regarded it as one giant set of commodities. And the whole notion of turning place into real estate, into something that can be bought and sold, developed and redeveloped in order to suit the needs of the market, is in a sense to go against any real preservationist impulse. Joseph Schumpeter, the economist, described capitalism as engaged in a process of creative destruction. And what's happened is that we, to also go back to Arendt, we've kind of taken the transformation, commodification, development of our landscape to an extreme where we're basically consuming it, sort of eating it up and then discarding it as waste. You can see this in our landscape of suburban sprawl, which may be the sort of quintessential landscape of the second half of the 20th century, in which you see a kind of cycle of building and abandonment. For much of the second half of the 20th century, cities were on the decline. They were abandoned by white flight, by disinvestment. Of course, there were still people living there who were sort of bore the brunt of a lot of this. So then as people moved out to the suburbs, and the suburbanization actually started in the late 19th century, but really picked up after World War II. So as people then moved to first to inner suburbs and then gradually to outer suburbs, the inner suburbs themselves started to decay, to become abandoned, to fall apart, to suffer disinvestment. Then you had people moving out to the outer suburbs, creating subdivisions, strip malls. Then you see now a lot of malls themselves have been abandoned. And so there's this cycle of rampant development without regard for history, for ecology, for human health, for quality of life. So rampant development followed by decay and dilapidation, and then just development further afield.
Could one generalize to say that one can make more money by creating or building something new rather than by preserving something that's already there?
Yeah, the market, the way the market and regulations and everything are all structured, zoning laws, et cetera, they've really encouraged this. In fact, a lot of this sprawl is not just the product of the market, but of longstanding government policies through much of the 20th century that actively promoted suburbanization and promoted disinvestment from cities. So in many ways, it's easier and more profitable to just keep building further and further out. Of course, that ultimately runs up into environmental limits in terms of the use of energy, of fuel, the whole the burden of commuting, et cetera, et cetera. The other side of this is that we've preserved a fair amount of land as wilderness, and I think that's great. But we've tended to do, and this is, I'm not the first person to point this out. Other people like Michael Pollan and Bill Cronin have also made this point before I did, that we take part of our landscape and we sanctify it and preserve it, and that's wilderness or parks, which are, you know, used much more than wilderness, but are still protected. And then the rest we basically throw to the into the jaws of the market. So, you know, we have this kind of split mentality of, you know, pieces that are preserved, but then the majority is really commodified. Now, I'm caricaturing it to some degree, but that's sort of the, in many ways, the general pattern.
Peter, you note in your book, The Working Landscape, that many politically progressive academics tend to disparage notions of preservation as static and reactionary. Really?
Yeah, I think that there is a tendency among academics to value mobility, hybridity, flux, change. That notions of preservation have a kind of taint of conservatism, of reaction. There's a concern that place means parochialism, exclusion. And certainly those are real concerns in terms of pathologies of place and preservation. I mean, these values can be taken to extremes or into sort of perverse directions. But I also think we really lose something when we move away too much from stability, from preservation, because those values themselves actually, though in some sense conservative, are also quite radical today. Our society and its sort of capitalist ethos is very much built on constant change, on creative destruction, on transformation, and subjecting people to the sort of unrelenting forces of the market and the whole notion, well, that's progress, you can't do anything about it. And the notion of stability and preservation in the face of that is actually, I think, quite radical. And this is in some ways why environmentalism, which in some ways is a deeply conservative movement, is also extremely radical in the context of capitalism. It really opposes that sort of ruthless transformative aspect.
Peter Canavo, he teaches in the government department at Hamilton College. He's author of The Working Landscape, Founding Preservation and the Politics of Place. He's co-editor with Joseph Lane Jr. of the volume Engaging Nature, Environmentalism and the Political Theory Canon. You can read an article he wrote therein about Hannah Arendt, Place, World, and Earthly Nature. Thanks so much, Peter, for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.